Making a hit record is tough, but maintaining success is another skill entirely. On The Art of Longevity, we explore the artist's experience of the music business from the inside. I want to find out what separates those artists and bands that have survived decades in the music business from all those who've fallen by the wayside. We follow a narrative inspired by a quote from Brett Anderson of Suede, who said that all successful artists have followed a similar career arc, like stations of the cross. The struggle, success, excess, disintegration, and if you're lucky, enlightenment. With insights and stories for music fans, aspiring musicians, and creators, this is The Art of Longevity. The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the revered British premium audio brand. Hello, discerning listeners. Keith here. Just by way of quick introduction before this week's episode, I'm looking at the sleeve notes for the album Big Sigh by Marika Hackman, who is my guest on this episode. On the label copy, as we say, so that's the bit that tells you who made what on the record, and sometimes you get the lyrics and everything, and they're all on here. It's actually a wonderful package with a inner sleeve exclusive art poster and generally great design. So it's written and produced by Marika Hackman, the album. But also, Marika is credited with vocals, piano, guitar, bass, drums, percussion, backing vocals, synths, additional programming, and the sarangi. Now, I don't know what a sarangi is, but I know what the rest of those things are, and I just find it incredible musicality and a truly independent spirit for Marika to be doing all of that work. But on the record too, there are of course many other collaborators. She works with Charlie Andrew, who's best known for his work with Old J on engineering the and mastering of the album. And there are session players as well, because there is a horn section and strings on the album and lots of fantastic arrangements. So we talk about that in today's episode. Just the sheer creativity and responsibility that comes with being at the center of all of that creation, and then the center of you as the artist and business. So going on tour, we talk about what it's like to do that and make it work. What happens when you get to your fourth or fifth album, which Big Sigh is, and, you know, into the second decade of her career as a real deal artist, but not necessarily as a chart or a hit artist. How does that work, and what the industry might do to change and represent those artists better? Because in my view, Marika is, to all intents and purposes, the next wave of classic artist, and therefore a national treasure as well from the perspective of a British singer-songwriter and troubadour. So we talk about all of these things, plus Marika's typical song themes, which sound more challenging than they are when you listen on the records, but they are things like blood and bones and bodies and sex and all of these things that seem to be recurring themes in her music. Why do they come up? And most of all, what she's looking forward to most about being a musician in the industry now, being truly independent spirit, as I said, and how she's going to move forward into the future. I've no doubt that she will go on to become a classic artist and will probably make the masterpiece very soon. So this is episode, where are we? Episode 4 of season 9 with Marika Hackman. Marika Hackman, welcome to The Art of Longevity.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for coming in to Cube East. It's very nice here.
It's very swanky. I love there's some blue LEDs lighting up the ceiling, which feels very sort of R&B.
Yeah, it is quite R&B, actually. So I've been really keen to get you on. I've been a fan for a while, and you're, what, 5 albums in?
Yeah, it's a funny one, that, because technically on paper 4.
Yeah, okay.
But then there's the covers record, which makes it 5. And then there's also a mini album and like 3 EPs. So there's kind of straddling quite a lot there, but I think five is a nice kind of middle ground number.
It's nice to talk to you after Big Sigh's been out for a while, but it's sort of bedded in. It's the dust has settled. Just tell me about the recent shows. I heard the Hackney show was amazing. So you've done some UK shows.
Yeah, just finished last week, actually. We just finished the first like UK tour I've done in about 4 years, culminating in Hackney Church, which was an amazing show to play, to be in a space like that. I love playing in churches. It's always a bit of a battle with the drum kit, just because you've got so much pinging around. But it's just something from a church, you can always see the crowd really well. Everyone's very like present. It's just they're kind of all in the position where you can see people's faces, which I actually really, really like. I didn't used to like it, but I like it now. But yeah, it was a good tour. It was exhausting. I think coming back into it as a 32-year-old now is much, much more of a struggle, especially when, you know, it's still very much at a kind of level venue-wise that I've basically been playing for the last 8 years of my career. So that becomes harder. Just, you know, I don't really have any crew or anything. It's like lugging stuff around, yeah. Still dressing rooms that can only two people can sit down in at a time, that like don't have heating, and eating baguette, basically. It's not really now what my home life consists of at all.
It's not a posh rider then?
No, it's not a posh rider. It's the most bog standard rider you could ever see. Hummus, bread,
hummus and cheese, bread.
Basically. Yeah, yeah. And a few lagers. So that is the vibe. But luckily, I absolutely adore my band. We're all really close. And being able to play shows and see the crowd and meet people and things like that, that still kind of sustains you. But my God, the difference between being 27, 28 to 32 and doing this stuff, I had no idea how much of a drop in my stamina there would be. But, you know, I'll ease back in, I think.
So it's about managing your energy a bit more evenly. So how do you do that?
I mean, it's kind of just trying to find sleep where you can. I mean, the shows, you know, they're like, you don't get to bed. It's usually about 1 o'clock every night, which I'm not like that at home. I'm very kind of invested in good sleep and getting up early for the dogs and stuff like that. Like, my life is very different now.
What time do you get to sleep after a show? Because you must be
It's like 1 o'clock. So it's like, you get, it's kind of, I can, once I hit the pillow, I'm fine. But there's just, you know, like loading out takes ages. So you're loading out, there's usually a bit of a drive to the next venue. I sleep in a room with two of my bandmates, and they tend to like to have the telly on a bit before we go to bed, kind of thing. And we'll probably be a bit buzzy and kind of chatty. So kind of, I think we were averaging, it was about 12:31. And then kind of, I can't not wake up at like 8 anyway. So I would be awake being completely silent whilst, again, my bandmates were sleeping in. That kind of a vibe.
Yeah, okay. Got it.
And then you hit the road, and yeah, it's kind of, I think it's just taking time to like sit and do nothing, which is always hard when you're around lots of people. But that's what I do a lot of the time when I'm on my own, is to just, I genuinely just sit down and do nothing, like stare into space, and kind of feel like my brain and body just recalibrate.
Yeah, so it's kind of recharging.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a friend of mine once told me about this. I can't remember which philosopher it was, but there's this idea of work, play and leisure. And we often confuse play and leisure, and that like active play is actually so different to just sitting down, and you're supposed to have all three in complete balance. So I really try and make an effort to just stare into space as much as possible.
And so at Hackney Church, I'm assuming the Sonics, like once you'd got the drums sorted out, really worked for you with the Big Sigh album, because I mean, sonically, it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's perfect, because it's got that expansive kind of dynamic feel with that kind of huge reverby space. And also I've integrated a lot of like my earlier record stuff back into this new set, because when I release a record, I pull the set into the new world, if that makes sense. So I have to curate a Big Sigh set out of all the stuff I've released before. So it made a lot more sense to have some stuff from We Slept at Last kind of back in. And those tracks as well, my God, like in a church, or just when it's basically just me and an acoustic guitar with just some, my band doing sort of Atmos and a few kind of cymbal rolls and things like that. It's the perfect space for that kind of soaring vocal, and it's my favorite way to perform that kind of music. I get completely lost in it, which is lovely.
And you're planning a European tour. Logistically, nightmare?
No, I mean we're going, that's in just over a week, we'll be on the road there. And I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, I think there's only six shows the European tour, and there's it's two on, day off, two on, day off. I had four in a row on the UK tour, which was quite a lot for my voice. The set's a bit longer as well, now it's like 120, which is a lot of singing. So I think I might pare back the set a little bit, and also having those rest days will make a big difference. I also do, it's really fun going abroad and seeing different cities and things like that. You get to do it a lot less. So there's that kind of aspect to it that's slightly more fresh in the brain. Kind of, there's a more of an explorer part of me that gets activated, which is makes it more exciting.
I listened to your interview on 101 Part-Time Jobs on Gerald Bidder's podcast, which I really love. And you were saying that, and I've heard this from other artists, I guess around sort of your level as well, that you don't really make money from touring, which is extraordinary to me. And it's goes against the common wisdom, which a lot of people feel that's the way artists make money these days. So how does that work?
I've got to the point, so I've been doing this for 13 years. I've been playing shows since I was 16, so that's even longer. But I've got to the point now where I would have made a profit off my UK tour, but with that bundled in with the European tour, it's a perfect break even. So not making, not losing, which is fine. It is hard, like I was saying, with the kind of stamina aspect of things, and it is really hard work. Like, it's fun in games and it's great to do something that you love, but it is very hard work. And sometimes the idea of like actually doing hard work and having a paycheck at the end of it feels like quite an amazing idea and concept that would feel a lot more kind of comforting in those moments of, oh, fuck this, I'm knackered and I can't get out on that stage, I haven't got the energy for it kind of times. But at least, I guess, if it's breaking even, it's sustainable at this point financially. So that's how we've got to this point. I mean, it involves obviously labels investing earlier on, taking a hit on tour support and things like that, and having people that kind of believe that you're going to get to the point where it's going to start paying back. I think it's quite hard though, because a lot of the time labels have this assumption that they'll pay out for like one tour at the beginning of your career, and then after that, that's you're a self, you know, a machine that will just run by itself. And it's really hard to break that ceiling. Like I said earlier, it's like I've been doing this for a long time. And the tour we just did, I've played pretty much every single one of those venues apart from Hackney Church before, at least twice, if not three, four times. So it's the same circuit again and again and again, which is sometimes demoralizing. But then you meet the people afterwards and they've been listening to the new album, or, you know, they're still like following a journey and you're still kind of showing up for them, which is like lovely and heartwarming and kind of inspiring. But yeah, it's really tricky to break that ceiling just to that next level. Once you're there, once you can financially support yourself touring, you can just keep going and growing, because it will just run by itself. And then you can go anywhere with it. If you can't get to that point, what are you going to do? You know, and especially if no one's going to invest in you because you're 10 years into a career or something like that. And it's like,
okay, so the nature of where live performance comes into it feels like it's changed. As you say, you've got to get to that point where you step up in venues, you step up in the amount of dates that you can do on a tour, and then you kind of crossed the Rubicon.
Yeah, and you can only do that if you can earn off the tour initially to be able to, otherwise you're just, it's a money pit. And also the other thing that's really difficult is people don't realise how much it costs to put on a show. So like, if I look at the breakdown costs, which I've only just started doing recently, I think maybe getting into my 30s, I'm suddenly, show me these budgets and breakdowns.
You want to have a look at the accounts.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, hang on a minute. And it's crazy. It's just stuff like, you know, like the actually hiring the venue, like when you get the promoter's costs all through, things that will end up on there will be like towels, which is something that I never would ask for, because I don't get particularly hot on stage because I'm not, you know, thrashing around. I'll have been charged like 40 quid for some towels kind of thing. You know, you kind of look at these and it's like everything here is actually just costing so much. And actually the artist is ending up fronting a lot of that out of their fee through the promotional costs. So it's like, it's this whole, you keep digging back and back and back, and then you always find your way back to the artist digging into their pocket. And that's, it costs so much. So it's so hard to earn money. Yeah, it's like crazy. But like I say, if you get to that point, you know, fire away. You can just keep going and going and going.
maybe don't look at those numbers too closely because it's going to give you anxiety. But then on the other hand, you know, you don't want to be charged for towels.
No, it's good because towels. Exactly. Actually, you know, that's something I would suggest that a lot of artists do start to do is look at those things because, like I say, I have a very basic rider. That's partly because if I do the brake percentage where I hit the 80%, the rider then actually comes out of my profit. So I need to keep the rider actually fairly sensible. If I'm chucking two bottles of champagne and a packet of tobacco and three packets of tampons or whatever on there, all these expensive things, it's like, oh, that's just come straight off of any profit that I would have actually made on that show.
What about merch?
Merch is great because that does just come straight back in. It's a really good way to support an artist. But the trouble is, like, tickets are expensive. Merch is expensive. And I almost feel bad when people have bought tickets to a show at like 20 quid a pop in this day and age to then be sort of like, help a gal out, buy a t-shirt. But the reality is that ticket is wonderful and it will go back into the machine and it's all good optics, selling tickets, selling out shows, and that helps for festival bookings and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But actually the 40 quid you might spend on like a hoodie, that's just going to go straight back into my account and we'll all just be shaving off the amount that it costs to make that hoodie. So, yeah.
It's a delicate balance, isn't it? Because, you know, in the industry, we talk about monetizing fans and super fans and artist communities and all of that being the future. But actually, the artist, it's a mixed bag because you don't want to feel like you're fleecing your fans for everything you can get, right?
It also shouldn't be the way around that it is. I think the societal structures we have in place in terms of like economics at the moment, or even just like societal guilt. I feel like everything gets put on the little guy. So we have to take the hit to sustain the thing as opposed to the things at the top that are actually absorbing all the money upwards. It's kind of their issue. And that, like, that's where these things should be solved. It's not up to my fans to sustain my career by having to reach incredibly deep into their pocket. It's up to my fans to sustain my career by buying a record because they like the record and they want to listen to it. But like, they're not here to like support me in that way. Like the industry should be facilitating people making great records and people wanting to buy them. Like that's basically the end of it. And now we find ourselves in a position where artists are having to kind of do these creative and somewhat kind of demeaning ways to try and get money off of their fans. Why has it become between artist and fan as opposed to artist and labels? It's the wrong way around. Yeah. And I think I don't like it at all. And I don't like doing that sort of stuff. I find it difficult.
Yeah, it's interesting. It feels like the infrastructure behind any of the silos, so the live business, the streaming business, even, you know, products like merch and vinyl, that infrastructure is huge. And folks that are sitting on the top are milking it quite heavily.
Yeah.
But it seems like it's draining all the time from the artist and the fan. And, you know, it's like, that's why artists are burning out, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And I think it's all the expectations as well of like, it's not even just getting out on the road or producing quite like prolific amounts of music that I think is quite expected now. But it's also all the other stuff that I hate. The talking to selfie cam, like thank yous to fans for listening to records and things like that. Like, that's not the exchange. It makes it all feel quite like the artist is so beholden to their fan base for supporting them. And again, that's not how it really should be. You should be appreciative. There should be a mutual respect between artist and fan. And I respect all of my fans. And I love that they love the music that I've created because that's what you want. That's the thing. But also, like, do they really want to see me on my phone, just being like, kind of facelessly to any of them? Hey, like, thanks so much for listening to being in my top 0.01 Spotify Wrapped, whatever this year. That's the stuff I find really burning out because it's, you know, it's just requesting things through and through liners and et cetera, et cetera.
I hear it a lot. I mean, and I empathize with it. Like, I think there's a book out called Social Media is Bullshit.
Sounds great.
And the point is, it's like, they are networks and platforms for us to do what we do, so communicate between each other and fans. But the narrative that's become the overbearing narrative is you have to build your audience here. And of course, that, you know, someone's making a huge amount of money from that. It's not you and it's not me.
Yeah. And I find it funny as well that you'll find there'll be an artist who will go viral on TikTok because their song gets used in something and it gets tagged, you know, and all of that. And then suddenly every kind of label and management is turning around and going, well, okay, so X did this. So if you do this too, that's going to work. And again, it's like, it's always chasing the tail and forgetting that actually the person whose song went viral, they weren't trying to get that to happen. So why aren't we looking at why that happened as opposed to just trying to copy it somehow? It all just seems so illogical to me. And I think that's why I find it really frustrating that you just get told and sort of told you've got to do these things. I mean, I'm lucky actually, the people that I work with, but I say no quite a lot and they're like, okay, fine.
Yeah, it's about breaking the mold. I mean, yeah, it's why, 100%. You know, I look at, you know, the last dinner party, which has been there's been a lot of press and stories about them. But in a way, the reason there is because they've broken the mold. So it feels like that's the thing to do. It's like come up with a creative idea and just step away from the machine.
And just be really authentic and push that really hard. Like whatever you want to do, be authentic and do it. And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. It's not going to work if it's not going to work, no matter how many TikTok videos you make. That's the end of the day. So why be told that you have to do that is the thing. Like, you know, it's all about just making stuff that you feel is genuine and that you are in love with. Like that's the only thing that should really connect.
Hi, discerning listeners. A quick intervention here to tell you about another podcast I really love called 101 Part-Time Jobs with Giles Bidder. Giles is a broadcaster, podcaster, and music journalist. And 101 Part-Time Jobs, it's sort of joined at the hip with The Art of Longevity in a way. But the focus is more on artists in the first phase, or the first half of their career. Some of the artists have been on both shows, like The Staves, Marika Hackman, Real Estate, Teenage Fan Club. But Giles has also focused on a lot more new artists on his show. So Self Esteem has been on, Yard Act has been on, Idols. There's a great recent episode with the up-and-coming UK punk rap duo Bob Dylan. And I really enjoyed the recent episode as well with Bill Ryder Jones. So that is 101 Part-Time Jobs with Giles Bidder. I think you'll really enjoy it. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, Big Sigh was released in January. Your fourth album, as you say, fifth, if we include the covers. Yeah. So reading the reviews for that album, there's a consensus that you've just been progressing. You've just been getting better and better.
Excellent.
It's tough for you to be the judge, but first, does that mean anything? And secondly, did that build your expectations for the record?
That really does mean something to me. I very much am someone that really prides myself on doing the best I can do with anything, whether it's making music or like when I worked in a pub, it was like I was so fixated with how to pour like the perfect pint or pouring the most pints in the shift out of everyone behind the bar. Like I really like doing my jobs very, very well, which is great when it comes to like creative stuff because that's just really fun and lovely way to really flex that side of my personality. So whenever I sit down to start a new record, I'm always like, this one's going to be even better than the last one. And that's kind of how I've approached every single one and been like very much focused on playing with different genre and pushing myself in different ways. But the main thrust is always like, I'm going to be better. And what was actually really interesting with Big Sigh, I don't think I really thought about that this time. Because it was really hard to write. I had such bad writer's block and it took ages. And I actually stopped thinking about what it was going to be and really had to focus on the task at hand and just making sure I could even get it over the finish line. And it was actually really hard to see the wood for the trees after I'd made that. And also, you know, it came out in January, but I finished it over a year ago, mastered it like a year ago. So having fresh perspective, and I read reviews, so I'm obsessive about reading reviews as well. Like, it's not like it's ever going to change whatever I'm doing, but of course I want to know what people think. It's an interesting take seeing it through someone else's eyes. So when the reviews are saying that it feels like a real progression and I've moved into like a new phase of my career and things like that, that is really kind of fuel in the tank, I suppose, of like, okay, great, that one that was really hard to do, that was a bit of a struggle, that I couldn't really tell at the end of it, like where I, what I was even standing within. I can now look at that with the help of these extra eyes and ears and go, yeah, that's, it's a real great record. And that's like so nice. And now I'm just very, very excited to write another one because I'm like, well, this next one.
Yeah, I like that. Next one, so it fuels you.
Yeah.
So it's more than just validation.
Yeah, it's like a fire. It's kind of like, I need people sometimes to be like, you just keep going, like keep going, you can do this and you are good at this. I do need that. It's really lonely being a solo artist, writing music on your own, making demos on your own. Generally when I'm in the studio, there's just one other person there. It's really hard to get that perspective, and sometimes I just need people to be like, keep on going. And then I'm like, okay, yeah, okay, I can. And then I get really excited. Yeah. And kind of,
yeah, well, you can lose that perspective, I guess. When you're so deep inside it. And I was reading the sleeve notes last night, and it's Marika Hackman, vocals, guitar, drums, bass, yeah, percussion, couple of exotic instruments, yeah, I've never heard of. So you really did do it yourself. But then also you have a string section,
yes,
a horn section. Mm-hmm. So this was a lot went into this.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't do the record on the cheap in any sense.
Yeah. It was as cheap as we could do. It's hard, also again, people don't realise as well, records are really expensive to make, unless I'm going to just sit at home and just make it in my room, whatever. Yeah. But trying to keep costs down is also a big factor, and that's actually partly why I've never been able to have like an actual string section before, or like a horn section. We've always had to just do the layering thing. So that was like, honestly, like the highlight, like a career highlight, and definitely the highlight of the record was like going to Rack Studios and recording those parts. It was just hearing it all being played at once back was just like magnificent. It was incredible. So that's definitely something I've got in my brain now moving forward as well.
It's got depth. I think for me, that's what separates an album like Big Sigh from a lot of other albums that, you know, I'll hear this year. Yep. In that, and it, maybe it's down to some of that orchestration and the instrumentation on the record, but also the depth of the song. So you really sort of flex your musicality on the record, I feel, so you, yeah, can kind of climb into it. So in that respect, I mean, one of the things I'm exploring in this season is classic albums. In this day and age, what is a classic album? Do you feel like you could make one? Or if you do, does anybody care? Which is the expectations thing, because what I'm trying, yeah, to say is you've made a fantastic record, so now what happens?
Yeah, well, yeah, I think I tend to lean towards the does anyone care kind of thing, but there's hard, you know, but people do care, they do. It's more about like what does now that phrase mean, because of course people care, but how many people need to care for it to feel like people care? I mean, yeah, the response to that record has been amazing. I don't know if it's my most classic record that I will make. That's in my gut. That's how it feels. I think this was a real way for me to, like you say, kind of explore my own musicality and the kind of structure of a record and the tempering of dynamics and how you balance that and everything. I think I've got songs that maybe feel more classic yet to come. I think I'm happy. I think I'm happy if I feel like I've made one. I think I've got to that point. I don't think I would have said that when I was 19. I would have been like, I have this idea of my career on the horizon. And I used to have this thing when I was younger that I wanted to be an adult that would take my kids to school, and the children at the school and the parents at the school would be like, oh, have you heard her music kind of thing? That it would be something that transcended like the ages. And, you know, that was my dream. That was my dream. I think you get older, and the horizon sort of starts to get a little bit closer. The time you've got to get there feels a lot shorter. And I think your expectations are much more heavily managed, which is kind of a relief, I think, especially in the last few years, just kind of, you know, sitting and thinking about it. And that actually I love writing music and I love making records. And I want to keep making the best I can possibly make, which is like I was saying, pouring pints, et cetera, that part of my brain. So if I can go on to now make another record or, you know, however many I will make, and I turn around and go, that's a classic album to me, I think that's fine. I think it's okay, you know. And this has been my job for my entire adult life. I've sustained myself off of it. if I can keep it going, if I can just keep that flame alive, I there's still a little part of me that has a hope that maybe I'll get to that touring level a little bit higher, or yeah, something might just click where it can just be a little bit more comfortable and a little bit less of a kind of, is anybody out there feeling? But, you know, it's what it is.
That's a very modern definition of success. Getting to a point where you're just more comfortable.
Yeah. That's the thing. The sustaining oneself is good, because I think you're told as well, especially with creative industries, if you can do that, that is success. You don't get told that in any other industry. Sustaining yourself in the financial districts, that's not what you're not going to be sustaining yourself on a 22K a year salary in finance, are you? You're going to be told that you're going to be making millions. But like with creative stuff, it's like, if you can pay your own bills, you've succeeded. If you can go on a tour, even if you're losing loads of money, you've succeeded. Like, that isn't success. That's just living.
Do you think people appreciate that, like fans?
I don't know. I felt there's been a lot of silence on these matters because it feels quite tacky to talk about money. Like, and because you feel a sense of guilt because of the whole, like, you're so lucky to be doing what you're doing thing, it almost feels like complaining. Whereas I'm coming from a place of, like, it's not complaining, it's just laying out cold, hard facts about what this actually entails. I'm sure people look at me and think, oh, she's been doing it for over 10 years, therefore surely it must be pretty, you know, ka-ching. It's really not. So it's like, I think that honesty is good. And I think that it's good for fans to know that, you know, there's always the joke, is the come to Brazil joke. So every time you post a tour, and then there's always one person that comments and comes to Brazil. It's like, I would love to come to Brazil. And that kind of, that's the ultimate, I think, that it kind of packages that up, that whole idea.
Thanks for listening to The Art of Longevity. I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. Please take a moment to rate the show, leave a review on Apple Podcasts if that's where you listen, and do spread the word. Also, you can sign up via the Song Sommelier webpage for our newsletter, artwork, and much more. Back to the conversation.
So, this is The Art of Longevity. Do you think about longevity? How do you think about it?
I think with longevity, I think it's about... Like, I don't think about it in terms of my career. I think about it as me in the eye of the storm of my career, and actually how long I can sustain it being me, just the human, just because it is tricky. And as I say, as that horizon shortens, and the sustaining oneself as opposed to really kind of like taking it up a notch. But I also think that, you know, you make records and you put them out into the world, they don't go anywhere. So by putting out a record that people have connected with, you kind of already have that now forever that exists. So in one aspect, just by purely releasing music, you have an eternal career. You have an eternal, that will exist. And in some way, you will exist within that for as long as, I don't know, music and the planet and humanity survives, probably 10, 15 more years. So it's like,
we're lucky.
Yeah. But so that's, you know, that's a really comforting thought. So whenever I think about making a record, it's just about really adding to that little pile of things that I already have that don't go anywhere. There's like, and people don't just forget about them either. Like, it's really nice. That's a really like comforting, wonderful thing. So that's the kind of main way I like to think about it.
You've created a number of great things and put them out into the world. And I think you're right. One of the great things about the modern culture, and I mean, even, yeah, dare I say it, those platforms we talked about before, is that anything can happen. Yeah. First of all, you don't have hit records. Would that help?
Well, depends on, well, when you say hit record, as in big sellers, top five
charts, radio all of that play, stuff. All that
well,
stuff.
The interesting thing about charts, so the reason everyone's always so fixated on the charting aspect of things, which I've been scooted off my top 40 spots for the last two, in the last couple of days, the reason that that's frustrating is because actually other aspects of the industry look at that. Like, it's, a lot of it's to do with like festival booking and things like that. So if you can get a certain level of charting, you're slightly paving the way for easier entry into other aspects. Again, it's always this kind of greasing the wheels thing. Basically, the industry wants to find things that are successful and then go, look at this successful thing, rather than go,
yeah, it's like collecting badges and stickers.
Yeah. I think it used to be a lot more like, look at this really cool thing we found, and no one's heard of it yet. Like, how about let's put this on our stage because we think this is great. Now it's like, who's going to want to come to this stage? Who's going to pull in the crowds? Okay, so this band's charted top 10 or they got a top 5 and all that sort of stuff. So that's why, annoyingly, that stuff matters. Again, that's not a big fuss thing for me, but in terms of like having a few hit records probably would help, but then depends how I had to make them, you know what I mean?
I feel like with the songs you have and the music you make, you could get a moment in some other way.
Yeah.
A sink or something like that.
Yeah, always waiting on that eternal big sink. That's
right.
How I felt since I was 19. I mean, I've had some good stuff happening on that front. And I had the last series of True Detective, I had a song in that, which was amazing. I actually watched that episode last night for the first time because I've just started watching True Detective. Things like that are actually really helpful, like really, really helpful. And I like it when it feels like two creative worlds coming together. I think it's really lovely. I think syncs are something that I really enjoy it when I get like one emailed through and I read the kind of brief of like the scene and what's happening. And I think it's kind of nice that someone's gone, ooh, this atmospheric, you know, this might fit. It kind of feels like a compliment, really.
Yeah.
So I love
someone
that
has well. Probably gone, this is very syncable.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's
like moody.
It sounds, you know, it's a way of sort of, sounds horribly commercial, but, you know, that is one of the aspects of your music that
I think
your favour.
What's nice about it is that's just off the back of me just putting a record out. That's the thing. I didn't have to do anything else. There's a lot of stuff, you know, with stuff like charting, you know, drop your record down to $4.99, you know, in the week of the chart and all of that to try and get people to buy 3 albums.
Gamification.
Yeah, I just kind of, I said absolutely categorically not. No way. It takes me ages to make these things and it costs a lot of money. I'm not going to sell it for £4.99 just so I can get a chart spot. Because if I start doing that, like all the other people that do, we're just going to keep showing the industry that we are worthless and that we're just completely being commodified.
Feeding the beast.
Exactly. So some of us think that we need people to not do that stuff.
Yeah. And not do it all the time.
Yeah.
Like you can maybe get away with it once or twice if you think it's really going to help, if it's going to move you forward.
Yeah.
You know, but do it with your eyes wide open. Don't make a habit of it.
Well, we should be valuing ourselves highly because the industry doesn't exist without artists. Every other aspect of the industry can be done by people who can be trained to do these things, and like writing a good song, connecting with people, being creative, creating something out of something that doesn't exist before and having your own unique identity within that. Like you don't go to school for that stuff. So I think we need to start valuing ourselves a little bit higher.
So tell me, because that's the self-belief thing, which for doing what you do, you need an incredible amount of self-belief. Yeah. But who's out there with you? Who is supporting you in feeling that way?
I have a really, really fantastic management team with Transgressive, and I've worked with them since I was 19. And they just are all so good at like G-ing me up and kind of, and guiding me as well, and listening to how I feel about things and kind of advising with that in mind. But, you know, the amount of times I'll have Tim or Rachel from Transgressive sort of sending me text just being like, you got this, like you can do it, this is great, keep going. So that is like a really wonderful thing. And then I've got my wife, who's also a musician. She's very good at keeping me buoyed up. My parents, I send them all my demos. My mum's always like, you know, you don't have to do this forever. If you want to quit, you can, if it's not making you happy, but you really should carry on. That's usually what
that's nice.
The kind of
that's very
thing.
Nice. Nicely put, Mum.
Yeah, yeah. So I've got a really good support system. And then obviously, like outside of that, there's even more. There's, you know, people from the label and friends, and just I'm really hot on sort of as well, like my home life being really just full of, it's really not chaotic at all. It's just full of like close mates and dogs and delicious food and chilling out and like really kind of like real nice connections with people. I think that keeps me very, very, very grounded. I'm not kind of like waltzing about doing anything particularly fancy or fun.
So when the next level comes, you're going to stay grounded, right?
I think so. I think this far in, I think hitting another level, the only thing that would happen is that I'd have such a profound appreciation for it, as opposed to a feeling of like, of course I should have this. And this is finally, you know, this is what I deserve. And therefore I'm kind of going to grow into this character of my career and myself. Like we come together in waves because of course, like I am enmeshed in my songwriting from personal experience, but actually outside of that, we're very like different things. And I think if I, you know, had a tour where I sold out, I don't know, just Brixton or something, that would be, I'd be like, oh my God, amazing. I'd be absolutely.
And it'd be happening at the right time, because I think I've heard you say this before in other interviews, you've never sought out, or you've tried to avoid that boom and bust career, which still happens now. I mean, I find it happens in a way more than ever because of TikTok viral hits and things. Yeah. But I mean, the whole concept behind having these conversations was the quote by Brett Anderson about, you know, the artist's career in the 90s, which was the boom and bust career for bands. It's like a stratospheric rise. They put you on a pedestal. You think you're God. And then it's all downhill from there. So you've actively avoided that. But it's when that sort of next wave comes, you feel, okay, you can be grateful.
Yeah, I think so. And I think I'm definitely with the kind of slower build career in mind as well. The only way that does work is if it keeps building. Otherwise,
yeah.
You haven't really had boom or bust, I suppose. Or just bust. But I think, yeah, the thought of having sort of very early, intense success, I think the pressure would have been too high. I think it would have really distracted me from making music. I don't think I would do very well with that as a concept. So I'm kind of glad the way it's been. And actually having a long career is, you know, tricky. And a lot of people don't get that. So I'm very like grateful for that. It's kind of now working out like how to go around the next corner and see what is going to be there.
So you are signed, you have a manager, you have a publisher. What is the conversation about how you know you've got to that next level or that you're succeeding now materially?
Well, I suppose I guess they all have different perspectives, and I have my own perspective as well. You know, label wise, I'm sure that's more to do with sales, charting, things like that, and just kind of raising the profile. So I put out Big Side with Chrysalis Records as well. So that's the first album we've put out together, and we haven't sat down and had any conversations about like how that kind of technically went. But I'd like to think, I mean, they're all like very big music fans, and Jeremy, who's the kind of head honcho there, is it's really nice. He just loves music.
Yeah.
And he's like so invested in that, which is,
I mean, you've been associated with some what look like good music reps, right?
I mean,
Dirty Hit, Transgressive, Chrysalis, yeah, they've all got pretty good reputation.
Yeah. And it's, I think the through line is people that really just care about music and that being, so maybe they would maybe turn around and go, well, you know, it's a shame you didn't get that top 40, but they're also going to turn around and go, but this album, we love it. And that's great. So I guess they probably have their own opinions and things. We haven't sat down and spoken about like those kind of levels of what that would mean. I know with management, it's very much just about like keeping on going, really, and like their care, their level of care for me, and making sure that I can keep doing that and finding ways to facilitate that for me, which is great management. That's the role at its core. So I feel like there's a sense that they're always feeling like it's ever inching ever more towards something, and there's going to be some kind of moment. Who knows? But it's nice having people around you that feel like that.
The Art of Longevity is recorded at Cube West Studios in Acton, and sometimes at the Cube East Studios in London's Canary Wharf. Cube is the world's first members studio for musicians, podcasters and content creators, and it's a real sanctuary for London's independent, inspired creators. It's a real pleasure to record the show here. All right, so one of the other secrets of longevity that we're discovering through these conversations is melding your influences, but in a way that's uniquely you. And, you know, when I listen to your music, the influences are clearly there. Bit of Elliot Smith here and bit of Radiohead there. Yeah. Who else?
I suppose there's different influences floating through all the very kind of different records. But I think the through line with the songwriting, I would have to go back to when I first was like picking up a guitar and considering this is something that I wanted to do or could even do, seeing if I could write a song. And that was very much like Laura Veers was like a huge inspiration to me as like a 14-year-old, and the Shins. And I think you can still hear those artists in my writing, especially the Shins, the way that they kind of wonky round some pretty weird harmonic structures. Joanna Newsom kind of then came into the fold, you know, a bit after that. You can hear her floating around. Then I kind of stumbled upon Warpaint when I was 18, when they had that first EP out. And that kind of was like, okay, cool, so I can take this side and I can take that side. And this is what I want to be. And I think this is kind of what I am. And let's create this kind of Venn diagram and see what happens in the middle. And I think really everything from then on was kind of informed by that central part. And everything else is more kind of production ideas most of the time. When I'm kind of listening to something, I'm like, I love the way that snare sounds or whatever. Boring. So yeah. And then also, I mean, I always say this, but I was really raised on like a bedrock of amazing songwriting. Obviously like Joni Mitchell, Stevie Wonder, Fleetwood Mac, Steely Dan. Like that was all the stuff that I was listening to when I was like a kid. As much as you're not going to sit down and say that I write music like Steely Dan, it's like, but that's the songwriting is just so incredible. How can you not kind of start to absorb stuff to do with like structures and harmonic progression and things like that without even thinking about it?
Well, you have some classical training as well, don't you?
Yeah, so kind of. I mean, I tried to have classical training, but I can't sight read, so that was got in my way a lot, and I didn't practice. But I did learn the piano when I was a child, and I did music up to A level, which obviously is 90% classical based. It was funny. It's just so mathematical and it's so kind of logic based as well. It's not necessarily intuitive. And what I found with learning about it and the language around it was actually that I was intuiting a lot of the actual tricks that old school composers were kind of using. And I just didn't know what to call them, but I was just doing that without, just from instinct, basically, which is kind of how everything that's been done in terms of my songwriting and production, it's all very, very instinct based rather than, you know, even just the way I play guitar. Like, I just worked out how to do it on my terms, I suppose. That's probably not the best ways.
Did you have an inspiration with the guitar playing? Because I really love the way you play guitar. Did you look at anyone else and say, yes, I want to do that?
No, I think it was the opposite. I think I looked at everyone else and thought, God, that looks really scary and I don't think I can do that. So I never actually had an inclination to learn the guitar. Whereas with the drums, I was like, I want to be John Bonham. I was like, I'm going to have four sticks and I'm going to be smashing this out, like double kick. That was, you know, for some reason with drums, I was like, this is totally achievable. I can be a virtuoso at the drums. Maybe because there wasn't music to be read. I don't know in that way. But when it came to the guitar, I never like wanted to learn the guitar because I just thought, oh God, well, there's too much out there. It's all too good and too complex, and I've probably already at the ripe old age of 10 or whatever left it too late. So when I just started using a guitar to write music, it took the pressure off because it was just purely a vehicle for making chords, which I found really hard on a piano. So that was great.
There's something really cool about the way music's made now, about the way artists are playing guitars, I think.
Yeah.
Especially women, like, you know, St. Vincent. Same. There's a lot of references and it's like no rules.
That's the thing. I think it's using guitars in ways that aren't about being a guitarist. And I think that's what's really refreshing. I think if I think back to when I was a kid and all the little boys around, it was always like, I want to be Jimi Hendrix. And it would be like, they would all be learning all their little solos. And it was all about soloing as well, always. So they were like 10-year-old boys doing Jimi Hendrix solos and showing off to all their mates, thinking they were really cool. And us girlies were sitting in the dark, using guitars in ways that were like, it never even occurred to me that I would use a guitar to do a guitar solo.
And it's so out of fashion now. When you hear a solo, I mean, it's interesting. We talked about The Last Dinner Party because, you know, there's some guitar solos in there and stuff. And it's, in a way, it's kind of coming back, but everything comes back around. But no, it's the guitar kind of woven into everything else.
Yeah.
It's a great way of using the guitar.
I think that's what's really interesting about artists like Kurt Cobain and Elliott Smith as well, because they both use their guitars. They're not guitarist-ing, you know. I'm sure loads of people would scream and be like, what are you talking about, Kurt Cobain? You know, but he's wielding something as a channel for something completely different, for songwriting and for connection. He's not standing there being like, look at me go. He's grappling with the noise coming out of this thing. And Elliott Smith is using that guitar to convey these songs and this heartache, all these really weird chords and progressions, which are really complex when you try and fucking learn them. But like, there's no part of any of his like performance that is anything to do with check out how good a guitarist I am, which is a trap I think a lot of people fall into, because it's very satisfying to be good at playing an instrument. It's fun to show off. But I think what's really interesting, that loads of women as kids really connected to those two artists in terms of their musicality and the way they play their instruments. Like, I wasn't really interested in Jimi Hendrix or Stevie Ray Vaughan or never. But when I saw videos of Kurt Cobain playing or listened to an Elliott Smith record, I was like, whoa, that's cool. And it starts to bring it into a world which is like, this isn't about that. This is about connection and making music. And that suddenly becomes completely open. It's an open arena for anyone. Anyone can do it. Like, I really think that if someone sits down and just, or I think anyone can play any instrument however they want, basically. It's the same way I think about visual art. It's, you're only defining it by the parameters you're setting yourself from what we've all been taught. But if you just change those parameters, then you're achieving something in your own way. And that's how, you know, people become inspirational, because they change the way that we do things.
Okay, so that was the kind of, that was the inspiration in a way.
Yeah, well, I think, I think also, with the Laura Veers one, actually, that she, when I listened to her, if her guitar playing is very simple, her songwriting feels quite simple, but it's so, it connected so heavily with me. It's so raw and emotional, and her voice. And I listened to that, and I think I was at that age, at that point, I think I was about 13, 14, where I felt it with my kind of young teenage brain. It was really like profound, and I suddenly thought, wow, I can probably play those chords if I tried. I could probably do that. And then I started writing music on the guitar. So that was a real like moment. The other stuff I was kind of still slightly skirting around. I was kind of like in bands with boys in my year, kind of like I was like on the drums, or I'd be kind of playing the bass in the corner and have all these ideas and just, you know, sit there.
You should listen to the Laura Beers episode.
Is there one?
Oh, yeah. She was number 3, I think.
Oh, my God, amazing.
Yeah, no, she was one of the first people on my list and one of the first to say yes. She's amazing.
Okay, I'm popping that on this afternoon.
Okay, so I think we've got like 5 or 10 minutes. I've got to ask you about the themes that recur in your songs.
Yeah.
I know everybody asks this, but I still want to know where it comes from.
Yeah.
It's very visceral. There's blood and guts and bones and sex.
Yeah,
and
sick and... yeah, all the rest of it.
And it is recurring. It's always there.
So yes.
Why?
So I think I have always been very, very fascinated by the things that unite us all. I think, in terms of looking for connections and things like that, I also find it really interesting that the stuff that unites us all is the stuff that we tend to find the hardest to deal with or disgusting, you know, or it becomes like a taboo subject. I think I'm kind of always trying to maybe slightly confront people with those things. That had been my answer, I think, as well, for like the first 5-6 years or so. I think I've realised latterly as well in the last few years that a lot of it relates back to my appendix bursting when I was 17 and basically having to spend 8 days in a hospital, near death, all of that sort of stuff. And I... at the time, sort of dealt with it in a very just like, it's cool, I'm here, that's fine, you know, ouch, whatever. Really, but actually it was all really intense and really horrible. And we've been in Finland, which is where some of my family are from. And we flew home, and actually on the plane ride home, I had my first ever panic attack. So this is age 17. And at the ripe old age of 32, so that's half my life ago, pretty much, I have had anxiety in some form every single day since then, having never, ever had it before. So there's a real like before and after, and it's all linked in with a really visceral thing that happened to me where I was really confronted with my own mortality and also with the fragility of our bodies. And it was really ugly and disgusting. Having abdominal surgery is, you know, a pretty demeaning thing. The recovery after that is pretty nasty. It was actually terrifying, and I didn't really confront it at the time. So I think that a lot of me going through those topics is me kind of trying to like unpick those, that terror that's like sitting still inside me and contributing to sort of, you know, anxious brain, which is, I mean, fairly commonplace in this day and age.
So it had a primal impact on you that you didn't maybe recognize at the time, and maybe you were too young to kind of get it anyway. But has it got rid of the anxiety singing about these things?
No, it hasn't got rid of it, but it's, I always say it's really nice to turn something so negative into something useful or something beautiful, like to take darker aspects of my day-to-day life that I've struggled with and go, haha, fuck you, that's not all you're going to be, because I've now turned you into this like beautiful song. It kind of makes me feel like I'm winning the game a bit.
Okay, so how would you sum up your relationship with the music industry, if you like?
Right now, I feel like we are sort of equals in the sense that I feel quite sort of empowered just by having been around the block quite a lot and feeling older and wiser and proud of myself and quite confident as to where I am. There's always the little kind of David and Goliath in the back of my brain, because obviously the industry is vast and I am a mere worm floating around in its earth. But in terms of the team I have around me and where I feel I sit, you know, I feel present and sort of empowered.
And if you were to give yourself advice when you were, you know, in your 20s and still on first, second album, is there something that pops into your head?
No, I always find it difficult if I'm feeling at a point that I think is good, and I also can't see how I could have altered anything in the past to make it even better. My advice would probably just be like, keep on going. And every decision you're making is a step towards just like this continued career and making records that you're really proud of, which is, like I've always said, is what I set out to do.
Does anything concern you, keep you up at night?
Lots of everything. I worry about the ecosystem of the music industry. And, you know, I'm in a precarious tier of that ecosystem. I worry that we're going to lose our sort of appreciation of like beautiful, well-crafted, emotional art, and that the industry is just going to sort of bow to whatever's the hot thing at the moment, and the thing that kind of is absorbed the easiest and maybe isn't the most inspiring or, you know, entertaining kind of songwriting you can get. I think we might lose or let a lot of really like beautiful, pure talent just slip through the fingers of the industry in the next 20, 30 years because of the way that I see it going, which is sad.
Yeah, I mean, I share that worry. I mean, that's partly why I did this, is the worry literally about longevity. But then on the other hand, you're making fine albums. There are lots of bands and artists who, we've talked about some of them, who are making just amazing records. And I think it's a miracle that it still exists, but I think it's because it's what we really want.
Yeah, I'm really hoping as well that there'll be a shift, a kind of collective consciousness shift of like the eye coming back around into like getting really into those kinds of bands, and that becoming like more popular in a way again. I feel like it just still feels quite niche. Yeah. It didn't used to be like that. You used to get these huge followings of these like kind of cult bands, and that's what would then break the band. And instead it's kind of like, it's a rarity. It happens every now and then. But it feels like everything, the pathways are coming from slightly different places. And it'd be nice to have that feeling of like really organic connection.
Yeah. 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 Because I think the material's there. I mean, there are so many good albums every week. And they are good. And yeah, they're 10 and 11 songs, which is a throwback to the classic days of old. And you can, it's on beautiful vinyl. I mean, your big size on, you know, I've got the, whatever, the olive green vinyl with a nice poster inside as well. And it's, you can sit, listen to it and look at the cover. And I know that that's what people are doing again. And young people are doing that again. So it feels like that's kind of part of the future for an artist like you. But we need to recognise that more as a as an industry.
Yeah, if it could just have that little injection of it taking up a little bit more of the occupied space, that kind of attitude, then I think the ecosystem starts to flourish at the level that I'm at, the whole kind of like, that whole tier that I sit within, because that's really important for artists like me. Like, because, yeah, Spotify's not really going to be handing out the...
Yeah, I mean, they've got this series on classic albums right now. So every now and again, they surprise me.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, somebody there cares. And then it goes away again.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's interesting. But yeah, I think they've recognized exactly what we've just been talking about. And maybe that's part of a change.
Yeah, I'm hoping. So. I really hope so.
All right, last question. What are you most excited about over the coming months and the rest of the year?
I'm most excited to carry on writing the next record. That's, I mean, like, I've got obviously a European tour next week. That's going to be fun. Like, I've got an American tour in September. That's going to be amazing. But above all of that, I'm so excited to just, I've written a few songs, but just to keep kind of going in that vein and hopefully have something I can whip into shape early next year.
Amazing.
We'll see.
Well, look forward to that. Well, Marika, thanks for coming on. I mean, you have crossed the Rubicon. You have to keep going. You just have to find a way to do it. So I really appreciate, you know, sharing the insights with us. And yeah, good luck for the rest of the year and beyond.